We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good morning. Late afternoon in Jerusalem. I just want to briefly introduce Rav Nathan Kamenetsky. Rav Kamenetsky and I have been corresponding for a number of years, and it's a pleasure to have him with us today. Rav Kamenetsky, as we said, was born in 1930 in the Lithuanian shtetl of Tytsevian, and he came to Toronto at the age of 8 years old, and was sent to Misifta Torah Vadat in Brooklyn in 1945 to study. He was ordained in 1952 and completed postgraduate rabbinic studies in New York State at Beit Medrash Elyon in Muncie and also at Beit HaTalmud in Brooklyn. In 1968, Rav Kamenetsky made Aliyah and was one of the principal founders of ETRI, which is the Israel Torah Research Institute. It's an educational network, and he served there in various positions until his retirement in the late 90s. For 15 years, Rav Kamenetsky did assiduous research on the book Making of a Gadol, which was published in 2002. Just going to give you a look at it. And we wanted to bring, and of course all of us are familiar with the fact of the publishing history of the book. It was published in 2002. It was subsequently banned. A second edition was published in 2005. It was subsequently banned. So we wanted to get together with Rav Kamenetsky this morning to discuss several issues pertaining to the book and its reception. I'd like to begin, Rav Kamenetsky, by asking you to describe growing up in your household. How many brothers and sisters did you have? Do you have? When did you become aware of your father's stature? And I'm also interested in something that's less talked about, which is the influence of your mother and what influence she played in your life.
Well, let me answer Dr. Malamet. May I call you Elliot?
You may.
First of all, when I came to Toronto, I was 8 years old. I'm one of six siblings. We have four brothers and two sisters. Now, and the question is, when I became aware of my father's stature, I would say that my father held a very respectable position in Toronto. He was the Rav of Eitz Chaim, which was down in D'Arcy Street, which is Chinatown now, I understand. Now, in my time, there was no day school in Toronto. And I went to the regular Ord Street Elementary School and later to Harvard Collegiate Institute, where I studied for 2 years. My principal then was Dr. Carlisle. I became aware of my father's stature as I was growing up when I was, let's say, 10, 11 years old. At that time, I would say my father wasn't known throughout the Orthodox world. He was a major rav in Toronto. There was competition between his kehillah and that of Rabbi Avram Price it was, who stayed in Toronto, I think, till the end of his days. When my father took on a position in the Siddur Torah Vadas in 1945, that is when I, with the rest of the family, moved to New York, and that's when I joined Torah Vadas. My mother was a woman who loved the study of Torah. As a matter of fact, when my father, who had a session in learning Torah with the husband of my older sister, Rabbi Shirin, of blessed memory, he died about a year and a half ago. And they would sometimes go off on a tangent and they begin schmoozing. My mother would peek into the door and say, Yaakov, that's how she called him, or Yaakov. Yaakov, the little that she knew, you'll also forget if you don't continue studying. If you don't continue studying. She had a lot of love of the study of Torah, and this is the influence my mother had on all of us to appreciate the study of Torah.
In terms of your own education, what kind of things did your father emphasize in terms of your own Torah study?
You're asking about the Torah study that my father emphasized. I wanted to add at this point that my father emphasized that I do well in my secular studies too. And I believe that the yeshivas in later years, when my father became more prominent throughout the yeshiva world, when he joined the Sifta Torah V'Das and he served there for several years, I think the school, the yeshivas, which paid attention, which paid heed to his orders, were ones that stressed that the secular and the education must be respected and must be given its due. I know there are some yeshivas nowadays, I've read about it in the popular press now, where children abuse the youngsters or young people abuse their secular studies staff, and my father was against it, very vehemently against it, because he felt that anything you study and you can benefit from, even if it isn't Torah, you have to put your whole self into it and derive whatever benefit you can. Now, so far as what my father stressed in religious studies, I'll tell you, actually, I don't think my father imposed himself on any of his children. If I have two brothers who are rabbis, and one brother who is a businessman, we all chose our calling on our own. Perhaps we admired our father, and we had a certain inclination to go into the religious field. But my father never imposed himself on us, and he let us do our own choosing. And so far as what in our studies my father stressed, I think he he respected the schools we went to, and he wouldn't try to outclass them. Like we were in our schools and our yeshivot, we were the same as any other students, and whatever this school we went to directed us to, that's the direction in which we went. Now, there's an interesting thing. When my father came from Toronto, he decided to move to the States, and he was offered a position in Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Rishon LeZion, and a position in Torah V'Das, and he said at that time that actually being a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, through that way he would have a greater impact on the American scene, because in those years Yeshiva University was the school that gave out most of the Orthodox rabbis. So his influence would be nationwide. But he said at that time that he felt that his children he'd want to send to Torah V'Das, not to Yeshiva LeZion. And therefore he decided to go to Torah V'Das himself, because he was afraid he would lose the influence over his own children. And although he would influence a lot of other children of other people in becoming rabbis, there's a rule in the Gemara and Kiddushin that if someone else's son wants to come and study under you, and your own son wants to study under you, your own son has the precedence. So therefore he felt, in order for him to teach his own children, he has to go to Torah V'Das, because if you teach him YU, then he won't be able to teach his own children. This is what he said then. Why did he feel the Torah V'Das was more of a yeshiva to his liking than the Yeshiva University? I think perhaps it was the fact that Taravadan had less secular studies than Yeshiva University. And he wanted us, even though he didn't, like I said, he didn't insist on it, let us do our own, let us make our own choices, but he himself was happier when we spent more time in Limudei Kodesh than in Limudei Chol.
Thank you. I want to move on to your book.
I want to add something as far as my own education. I only had 2 years of high school. Even the Torah Vadash had a full 4-year program. Because after the 2 years of high school that I had, I decided I want to learn full time. And my father respected my wish. I never did get a high school diploma from a Sitra Torah Vadash. Later, I did a equivalency test. It's called in New York State. There's a high school equivalency test. So the maximum was 376 points, and I got 372. Naively, I didn't know if I passed. I got the notification that I got a score of 372. So I contacted them and asked, did I pass? So they said I passed by 99% because I got 372 out of 376.
Yashar Koach. Given that you only had 2 years of high school, and I you call yourself an autodidact when it comes to secular knowledge, and I'm taking by this that you didn't really receive formal schooling in secular literature, to what do you attribute your interest in secular literature?
I'll tell you, my father, when he was, before he came to Slobodka Yeshiva, and he was a young boy, he came to Slobodka at the age of 15, and I described all the details in the making of a gadol. Because when I named my book Making of a Gadol, I'm basically speaking about my father's path in becoming a gadol. Until the age of 15, he lived in Minsk. That is, he came to Minsk even before his parents did. He came there and the parents came at the age of 11, and his parents moved there 2 years later, after his bar mitzvah. And at that time, when he was alone, he used to sleep in the Beis Medrash, where the school was. Each Beit Midrash had its own level of studies, and the Rav of the Beis Medrash would be the Rosh Hashiva. First, a student would learn in one Beis Medrash, and after he completed the course there, he went up to a Beis Medrash where the studies were more intense or on a higher level. Anyways, my father at that time dabbled in secular reading. It's just an innate inquisitiveness that made my father and made me read things besides what our school promoted. And I'll tell you, I don't think I ever told anyone this, but when after I finished Torah Vadash and I went on to the graduate school of Torah Vadash in the Smedrash Elyon, I subscribed to the New Yorker. I was just interested in all facets of knowledge. That's why I call myself autodidactic.
This is Making of a Gadol, and the first edition, which I read most of, was published in 2002. It's a fascinating document. It's not easy to read because of its structure, and as our friend Professor Mark Shapiro has noted, the book has very helpful maps, and it's beautifully typeset, and there are intriguing pictures of, among others, a very stylishly dressed Rav Aaron Cutler, who comes off as one of the more controversial figures in the book. Rav Cutler is a full orphan by the age of 11. One parent dies at 3 when he's 3, and the other dies when he's 11. And as well, his older brothers and his sister abandon religion. And indeed, you write that his sister became a math professor and bemoans the fact that her brother did not pursue academe. You also assert in the book that Rav Cutler dabbled in secular studies, that he was more interested in literature than in the sciences, that he was actually engrossed in Russian literature, authors like Pushkin. And you also write that it may be postulated that he had too much self-confidence, which was something that was edited in the second edition. Years later, as a teacher, he would shower students with put-downs. He would say things like, "You babble like a drunken Turk." But at the same token, he's also portrayed as a loving and very warm teacher to students. My question to you is, does he seem somewhat paradoxical to you, filled with different kinds of impulses? And do you feel that the complexity of the man is not so well understood today?
Well, you quoted from my first edition and the improved edition. Now, the trouble I had with the first edition started when a grandson of Rabbi Kotler felt that I didn't give the grandfather full due. And therefore, I watered down some of the things I wrote about him in the second edition. Like you mentioned, in the first edition, I wrote that he had too much self-confidence. And I think in the second edition, I changed that to say he didn't lack confidence or something like that. When you ask me about the put-downs that Rabban Kotler directed to his students, I mentioned that he did this when I write about an earlier era, when I write about Reb Lazer Gordon, who treated his students in the same fashion, and he would also put them down. But I want you to know that I stress in the book, people who read the book I'm sure noted it, that all this was done by these Rosh Yeshivas. When someone would ask a question in the middle of the shiur, in other words, when the Rosh Yeshiva delivers a lecture, he's so engrossed in it that he is back in the old yeshiva days when he's a student. And of course, when you enter the yeshiva, you hear people arguing among themselves quite vociferously, and I would say without much respect for the other. In fact, I'll tell you something perhaps you've heard of Rabbi Shlomo Lawrence. He was a Chavar Knesset in Israel for many years for Agudat Yisrael. He came from Hungary, from Budapest, and he came to study in Yeshiva Mir in the 1930s. He was one of several boys who came to study from Hungary. Now, he told me that when he came and he saw two boys arguing and learning in the mirror, and one shouting to the other, "You are a player, you're an amavet," and the other one is arguing back, and he's just trying to argue his point without respecting the other person's opinion. And he told me that when he heard that, he thought to himself that this would happen in a Hungarian yeshiva. When one student would speak to the other, he'd be expelled out of the yeshiva for speaking to the other in that fashion. But in Lithuania, in the heat of the argument, in the immersion that everyone had in his Torah and in his ideas, all this was taken for granted. Now, you mentioned before that I studied in the Beth HaTalmud. The Beth HaTalmud it was also called the Mirror Kolo. It was the top students of the Mirror Yeshiva who survived through Shanghai and came to America, and I was the fourth American student among the whole group of Mirror of students from Mirror. They were much older. As a matter of fact, some of them were already in the 30s and some in the early 40s. I witnessed personally the way the heat of the studies would make them forget whom they're speaking to and the manner in which they're speaking. Now, I think Rabban would yell that to a Talmud. The students took it just to show how much he's immersed in his Torah and how much he lives in the idea he's trying to expound. And he forgets himself. And if someone argues against him, he feels that he's right, He's going to put the other one down and say, you don't know what you're talking about. Rabban would express it in the words, you babble like a drunken Turk. Yeah, I mentioned in the book, what does it mean? Someone asked someone, a Purim, someone was brazen enough to ask his Rosh Hashiva, what does the Rosh Hashiva mean when he says, you babble like a drunken Turk? So he explained that a Turk understands what he's saying, just we don't understand his language. A drunk doesn't know what he's saying, but we do understand what he says. If he's a drunken Turk, he doesn't understand what he's saying like a drunken man, and we don't understand what he's saying because he's a Turk and we don't speak his language. That's what he meant to say when someone argued in his shir, he would say, you babble like a drunken Turk, not you know what you're talking about, nor do I know what you're talking about. But this was the heat of the Torah. Now, I'll tell you something else that my father said. I believe that I do mention it somewhere in the book. Dr. Shapiro, Dr. Mark Shapiro, mentioned that my book is eccentrically arranged. But, as you mentioned earlier, it's fascinating reading nonetheless. That's why when I mention about what I'm going to mention now, it's written in a different part of the book than when I mention about Rabban who's putting down his Talmidim. As I said, I mentioned that pertaining to an earlier Rosh Hashiva, someone who died in 1910. Reb Lazer Gordon was Rosh Hashiva in Telz, and he would also give the same kind of shir in which he would shout down and put down the Talmidim that asked questions in the middle. So my father said at one time that Reb Aaron surpassed him. My father, besides his being, my father's the one who lacked self-confidence in contrast to Rabban. So my father said, why did Rabban surpass him? At one time he says, because Rabban didn't smoke, and he was a smoker. And I write a blank about my father's bout with trying to break the smoking habit. I know now, Baruch Hashem, less people smoke, because now people know how unhealthy it is. But my father said that smoking clouded his mind, clouds people's minds, and therefore Rabban surpassed him. But at another time he said, because Rabban surpassed him, because when arguing, the point to learning, back in the yeshiva days yet, when they were buckling, Rabban could only see his point of view. And when someone else differed with him, he just couldn't see the other person's point of view. He thought I was 100% correct. And my father said, when I held something, an opinion in what I was studying, I saw my way, I saw the other person's method, and I preferred mine. But I didn't consider that mine is 100% the correct one, and the other one is 100% wrong. So when Rabban, when delivering the shir, he would put down the student to argue against it. It was merely an expression of this feeling about his Kedushei Torah, about his Maveli.
I understand. You're saying it was, in a sense, part of the culture then. Wasn't meant in the kind of insulting way we might take it today, but rather part of the warp and woof of vigorous and passionate Torah study. The other perhaps the towering figure in the book, is the altar of Slobodka, Rav Nathan Finkel. And you describe your father as saying something very interesting about Rav Finkel, which is that Rav Finkel did not want to exist. That's the quote. He wanted it to be forgotten that such a man ever lived. Now, I found that actually a fascinating notion. It seems to exemplify the trait of self-negation. And I'm wondering if this trait of self-negation was also an important influence on your father, if he learned that from the altar.
I'll tell you, my father considered it an achievement to reach the level of the altar whose interest was not in promoting himself to the world, but his interest was to develop himself. I'll give you an example. For instance, if Einstein would have theorized the theory of relativity, without telling it to the world. The world wouldn't have known it. But he himself would have looked, would have viewed the universe as he viewed it according to his the theory of relativity, which I don't understand and many others don't understand. But we all know that the whole universe is a different universe than the usual normative person sees it. Now, if Einstein would have his view of the world, and it would be a different view than the whole world has of the universe, and he goes on to his eternal reward. He might be satisfied about it, but if a person looks at how other people consider him, how other people evaluate him, then of course he'll publish the theory of relativity, as Professor Einstein did. Now, my father respected the altar very much because he was that kind of Baal Musser, that ethical person that he wanted to develop himself, to develop his view of the world, to develop his, nowadays it's a common expression to say, his relationship to God, even though it's a relatively new term. But if someone is satisfied with that itself, without trying to figure out how everyone else will look at him, I think it's something to be respected, and I found respect to the author of Sabatka very much for it. If it had an effect on my father, to a degree it did. Although my father had some interest in how the world viewed him, and I'm called for the author of Sabatka. My name, Nassim, is, I was named. The author of Sabatka died in 1927. I have a sister who was born in 1927. I was born in 1930. I was my father's first son, who was born after the altar's demise, and he named me for his Rebbe. And I'm just called Nosson, not Nosson Tzvi, for a reason I won't go into. My father held from the altar very much, although at times he said that he couldn't figure out what the altar was thinking. One time he said that there was a Baal Musser who came to speak, and the altar of Sabatka honored him by having him say his Musser Shmus in the altar Yeshiva in Sabatka, and the altar stood behind the bima, and he listened as the guest Mashgiach was putting down the Sabatka Yeshiva Bachrim and the Derech of Sabatka and all that, and the altar was smiling to himself, and my father said, I don't know what he was thinking, because it was no one could figure out what was going on in the altar of Sabatka's mind.
I wanted to move the conversation along to the introduction to Making of a Gadol, because you've said that regarding the book that you wanted to write real history as opposed to just hagiography. And you write that by telling the truth about Gadolim, their stature will be raised. And yet that thesis seemed to be rejected by those who banned your book. So I want to quote for our listeners a portion of the foreword to the second edition, in which you respond to the people who did not like what you wrote in the first book. You write, "The making of a gadol separated the mature-minded from those who never outgrow their childish thinking, the men from the boys, those who prefer sucking on fairy tales and myths from those who can swallow and digest reality and truth, those who must drug themselves and then totter alone and stumble in the complex world of ideas, from those who are sober and unafraid and hold the outstretched hand of the gadol in order to take secure and firm steps in the spiritual domain. The Gedolim, whose image is raised by men, conveys their holy and clear message from between the lines of a good and kosher book, while the Gedolim, whom the boys conjure up, never speak to their viewers, but remain in splendid silence while they float off in a mist of fantasy and disappear. Now, this is a very harsh, if very understandable, condemnation of a Haredi public that requires myth-making. I want to ask you, what do you see as the balance between preserving the truth historically and not undermining certain people's faith in Gedolim, or perhaps a way that they need to feel about rabbinic figures, the truth notwithstanding? So I want to ask you about that balance between historical truth and people's faith. And secondly, how do we begin to ease the masses towards a more nuanced and historically accurate picture of a Torah figure if the minute you do so in books like Making of a Gadol, the author gets banned and denounced?
Let me say first of all that although I was discredited by approaching the biographies of Gedolim in my way, nevertheless, I think I've had some influence, because after my book was out, several years later, a book came out called She'ifot. She'ifot would translate into difficult for me to translate it. She'ifot it describes how people would try to reach certain goals, and it speaks about Gedolim while they're trying to reach goals. I think that my book paved the way for that kind of approach. Now, one of the people who banned my book was Rav Shlomo Volbe, who is a famous Baal Musar. He passed away several years ago, and he wrote to me after I had a discussion with him about why he put his name down to the ban on my book. And he said that we try to portray the great figures in their after they have perfected themselves. Now, I don't see that is a reason why to ban a book which is called Making of a Gadol. In other words, I say very clearly, I'm describing the way the Gadol became a Gadol, the way he grew, the way he became from someone who was not a Gadol into a Gadol. Now, why I was banned exactly? Why there's a certain feeling among the Haredi society that they don't want to know how the Gadol looked before he became big. Insofar as a specific trouble that I had with the grandson of Rabban Kotler, I would say that the reason why he didn't want to have written what I wrote is merely because he's basing himself on his being the grandson of Rabban Kotler, so he doesn't want people to know that Rabban Kotler was at one time, as a young man, he wasn't Rabban Kotler yet. He was just one of the boys who also read Russian literature. I think he was just trying to promote his own interests by coming out against me. Now, I don't know exactly what it was that Rabbi Yashiv and the other people who countersigned, what they were told was written in the book, which they opposed. You seem to believe that the general idea of writing a book about Rabbanim, which is not hagiographic, is it makes it a ready trace. But I can't accept that at all. Because I was always taught that if you say the truth, you're on safe ground. This is what I was raised by my father to believe,
I'm just going to jump in for a second. I by no means believe that not writing hagiography makes a book trafe. You're talking to the wrong person. What I was expressing through the question is that the Haredi public seems to have difficulty with books that are historically accurate in the sense that they portray the struggles, the challenges, the difficulties of Gedolim. I completely agree with you. I believe that one should write historically accurate books, and I don't think that they undermine faith. I think they enhance faith. But that wasn't my question. My question was about the fact that given the reception of your book, the condemnation of it, notwithstanding that you say it has certain influences today, how do we begin to move the Haredi public towards a more nuanced and historically accurate picture of Torah figures if things like what happened to you occur, i.e. as soon as somebody tells the truth about a gadol, their book gets banned? That was my question. I'm asking a sociological question.
I'd like to answer that question by saying that I really can't take the responsibility of educating the Haredi society. I agree with you, and you agree with me. Now, if there is a trend in among Haredim that they don't want to hear the truth about how their leaders grew up and became the leaders of Klal Yisrael, I don't know how to overcome it. Rabbi Huttner wrote, and I do mention this in Making of a Gadol, in the introduction, that Rabbi Huttner writes that that no one should think that the Chafetz Chaim who wrote about he became famous by writing his book Shmirat HaLashon, against the evil of Lashon Hara, gossip and tale-bearing. So he writes that if anyone thinks that as a young man the Chafetz Chaim never spoke Lashon Hara, he's foolish. The Chafetz Chaim did speak Lashon Hara, and he made mistakes, and then he overcame his mistakes until he became the Chafetz Chaim who was able to write a book about Lashon Hara. He writes that very clearly. And I also quote a book written about the Chafetz Chaim's Rebbe, Rav Nochum Keh of Grodno, Rav Nochum Kaplan, also a book in which he also writes, this goes back to 1889, and he writes the way he grew up as a young boy, and the way he ran away from home, and he joined a group of wandering choir boys, and all that, and it was certainly not complimentary to Rav Nochum Keh, but this is the way he grew up. So I think that I wouldn't say that there is a blanket ban on portraying Gdolim as they're growing into Gdolim. My book was banned for a reason that I cannot tell you, because I was never told exactly what was it in the book that the Gdolim was like. I was never challenged what I wrote. As a matter of fact, when I heard there was trouble with the book, I challenged the person who came out against it, his grandson of Rabban Kotler. I was in California at the time that the trouble started. I heard that this fellow was in New York. And I left messages for him that I'll come back to the East, I'll come to New York, and let us stand in front of the assembly of the yeshiva students, and we should discuss it in my book. And he should say what's wrong with it, and I'll say what is not wrong with it. But he never took up this challenge, and I don't know till this day exactly what they had against the book.
Given what you just said, let's talk a little bit about the dynamics of banning in the ultra-Orthodox community. And I'm going to say this as somebody who's an outsider to the Haredi world. Many of us do not understand one fundamental point. At the top of the signatories of the letter banning your book is Rev Al-Yashiv. Now, if Rev Al-Yashiv did not read the book, then why ban it? If he did read the book, why ban it? If he promised not to ban the second edition before speaking with you, and then broke that agreement, or if he relied on others on what you call distorted reports, as you say he did, then again, why ban it? And my question really is that for many of us, this does not seem like the actions of a gadol. Indeed, it seems very petty. It seems unbecoming to ban something that one has never read, that one never checks out. There's nobody I know who would do this. Forget about the Gadol Hador. A simple school teacher would not do this. I would not do this. Yet you have consistently defended or rationalized his behavior. Can you explain why?
I'll do my best. First of all, the ban reads, it begins with the words, the ban begins with the words, I'm trying to find the translation of it exactly. The ban begins with the words, we heard from Talmidei Chachamim Ne'amanim, from trustworthy Talmidei Chachamim, that the book denigrates Gdolim and all that. In other words, Rav Yashi didn't say that he knows what the book says, he just says he relied on Talmidei Chachamim who are reliable, who told him that the book contains this and that. Now, therefore, the question is just, on whom does Rabbi Yashiv rely that made such a mistake? So there is that problem. Now, I'll tell you, Rabbi Yashiv is, I would say, the Gadol Hador when it comes to Pesach, all the halachic questions, all the difficult halachic questions, he come to his doorstep. And he gives his ruling. He's also a big political leader, because the Haredi world relies on his advice politically, because they know that his sole interest is to promote Torah life, which of course Rashad did before him. And he has taken over that mantle. Now, insofar as the Hashkafa, as the Weltanschauung that he promotes, I think we can differ with it. I know that Agudat Yisrael holds that the Das Torah, there's a term Das Torah, I think it's been already researched by the secular world, what is this, when did it come into being, this Da'at Torah, that the big Talmud Chacham can have the perfect Weltanschauung too. Insofar as that's concerned, I would say that since Rav Eliashiv relies on Talmidei Chachamim that are trustworthy in his eyes, and I do not consider them trustworthy, as a matter of fact, I would say they lied to him, and he believed them. I'll go into about the second edition, which was banned too. I'll go into that in a minute. So that puts his evaluation of people under question by me. If he relied on these Talmidei Chachamim Ne'amanim who are not Ne'amanim, then he comes under question, but that doesn't mean that his political leadership or that his Pesach Halacha is questioned. It is not questioned by me at all. I consider him the Gadol Hador. Now, in the in the second edition, which was then, when he told me, he assured me that he would call me in. I told him I've never met and spoken to him until my first book was banned. The first edition was banned. Several months later, I went to speak to him because I wanted to publish an improved edition. I wanted to get his approval of it. And that's the first time that I spoke to him. As a matter of fact, I had 6 meetings with Rabbi Yashiv about the question of publishing an improved edition over a period of 2 years. Now, all of this, my very first meeting with him, and my all the way through my last meeting with him, was recorded by me, and it's written in book form, but it's a book that I never published. I did publish a book about the ban, which is called Anatomy of a Ban. I'll show it to you also. It's called Anatomy of a Ban. It's about the ban, the story of the ban on the book Making of a Gadol. But this is only about the ban on the first edition, which I wrote before meeting Rabbi Yashiv. When I met with him, because I wanted to write an improved edition, I was trying to get his approval of it. I tried to get his approval, and toward the end, the later meetings, I stressed with him that if I'm going to write an improved edition and people are going to come to complain about it, you should call me and I should sit there with you while these people are complaining, so that anything that they say will be in front of me and I'll be able to show how they're fooling him. So he said, I'm right in asking for that. But at the end, he didn't call me in when he banned the second edition. It was a big problem, and all over the internet, all over cyberspace, they asked the same question as you just asked, how do I justify Rabbi Yashiv? So I wrote a book about this. See, this that I wrote, The Anatomy of a Ban, which I did not sell to the public, but I did give it to people whom I trusted not to spread it around universally. It has now become part of a trilogy. In other words, the first part of Anatomy of a Ban, part A, is the story of the Ban of the first edition, before I met Rabbi Yashiv. The second part, part B, by the way, part A I call the Shochri, lying down. Part B, which I call the Kumi, rising up, is after my meetings with Rabbi Yashiv, at which time I expected that there will not be a ban on my improved edition, for the simple reason that no one wanted to sit with me in front of Rabbi Yashiv, because after the second edition came out, the improved edition, after it came out, and it took many, many months for the new ban to come out, because no one dared come to Rabbi Yashiv, because Rabbi Yashiv would tell him, I'll come Rabbi Kamenetsky in too. And no one dared sit in front of me and confront me with his complaints about the book. It's a very, very interesting story what happened here. But at the end, Rabbi Yashiv did ban it because he decided that if people who weren't mixed into the first ban come along and complain about the book, he doesn't have to call me in. And by the time they found a couple of people who told him that they weren't involved in the first ban, and they read the second edition, which was false, which they were involved in the first ban, they simply lied to the Gadol Hador. They lied to him when he said they weren't involved, and then when he said they read the book, but he didn't call me in because he was assuming that I'll teach Naim Edim Yakum Davar. There are two witnesses, and they say, and he trusted them and he believed them, so he issued the second ban. In the second ban, he writes that I heard And he names the two people I heard from, this person and that person. He names Rabbi Don Segal and Rabbi Yosef Rosenblum. Rabbi Don Segal is one of the famous mashgichim in Israel, and Rabbi Yosef Rosenblum sits in Brooklyn, the head of the city yeshiva. So I heard from these two that the new book is no different from the old book. In the first time, he said, I heard from trustworthy Talmidei Chachamim. In the second then, he wrote, I heard from these two people. Why did he name those two people? Because he was trying to say, I heard some people who weren't involved in the first ban. But these two people were involved in the first ban, and they simply lied to the Gdol Hador. I know I'm saying this publicly, and it's a very strong accusation, but this is exactly what happened. And that's the third part of the anatomy of the ban, which I call Part C, Forlorn.
Yeah, I've read Anatomy of a Ban, actually. I've seen it at somebody that you gave it to, and I don't want to discuss it since you chose to keep it private. So I'm just going to stick with what you've just said. The part that's inconsistent to me is that if Rav Eliashiv made you a promise to call you in after the first one, we can no longer talk about the fact that he was misled by people, which is the rationale for the first banning. One would say, okay, you know what, he had people he trusted, he shouldn't have trusted them, the book shouldn't have been banned. Even though I actually find that an incredibly weak rationale, I'll accept it. But it's a rationale that does not apply to the second banning. If a person gives his word that before I do anything, I'm going to speak directly to the author, notwithstanding other people may come along and say it's the same as the first book, again, that seems to me to point to rather an ethical shortcoming and hardly worthy of somebody who you are calling the Gadol Hador. I'm wondering if all of this has had an effect on your whole relationship to ultra-Orthodoxy, how it's affected your standing in your community and your trust level for people in that community.
Well, my standing in my community has certainly been demoted. There's no question about that. If you're asking whether the stature of the Gdolim has also been lowered in my eyes, I think I delineated my view of the Gdolim in the earlier words that I said, that in certain things I do consider them to be my guides, and the other guides of the Haredi world. When we speak about the Haredi world, we're speaking about a political entity. And I said before that these Gdolim are the political leaders of the Haredi world. And they have the wherewithal to be the leaders. Why? Because their concern is to promote the existence of Torah in Klal Yisrael and to promote its study, and therefore they are the worthy political leaders for the Haredi world. Insofar as, let's say, the personal standing of the Gdolim, I'll tell you frankly that a person has to use his own head, and I used my own head when it came to judging people, including Gdolim, before my book was banned and after my book was banned. I don't think a person should submit his whole thinking and his whole evaluation of people to what others look. I think this is a Chassidic outlook, that the Chassid asks the Rebbe about everything else, and he's just a pawn of the Rebbe. But we Litvaks, we Lithuanians, we have our own minds and everything, including the evaluation of our leaders. As a matter of fact, the Chazon Ish said, it's important to know, to understand the personality of the Gdolim of our time. Each person in his own time should he starts to sit at Lashon Hara, if he evaluates or discusses what the Gadol is like, because this is a very basic, important thing for each person to know, and to know on his own, know how he feels about it. So therefore, when you say the fact that Rav Yasha made a mistake when he banned my book, they say it was, did his stature fall in my eyes? No, it did not. Why? Because not everyone can make a mistake. He happened to make a mistake when it came to me, and I was hurt by it. But that doesn't mean that I hold less of Rav Yasha than I held from him before. I knew he was fallible before, and he was fallible afterwards. I would just suffer the brunt of his fallibility. But he didn't fall in my eyes, no, not at all.
I wanted to ask you about the future of making of a Gadol. Originally, the project seemed to be oriented towards multiple volumes. In other words, if I understand correctly, the first volumes that came out in 2002 were only supposed to be the first part of what was going to be an ongoing series. And I know that you put in many years of research, in fact, research that far superseded simply the output of the first volume. I and many of my listeners would like to know, will there be publication of the next parts of Making of a Gadol, given the status of the first two editions being banned? If the answer is no, I guess that raises a serious question, which is that if you believe, and we believe, that there's historical value and historical truth in what you're writing, what would be the rationale for subduing it? In other words, for not putting out any more volumes, what would be the loss to historical truth, and why should historical truth be suppressed if the bans were incorrect in the first place?
I'll answer that question at length. First of all, an author, and I write that in the Anatomy of a Ban, an author needs a certain drive in order to go on for years and years, as I did in my research. Now, I did research. In my research, I also have material for the next volume, because my first volume only reached around 1909, and my next volume was supposed to be until the outbreak of the Second World War, or I should say until my father leaves Lithuania. For several years, when I was busy with the band, I simply didn't have time to pursue the making of a Gadol further. I agree with you fully that it has historical value and it should not be subdued, and I had no intention of subduing it. Even though for a while I lacked that inner drive to pursue the work in it. Now, I'm 78 years old at this time, so I'm getting on in years, but I do intend to go on. The first thing that I want to write after is finishing this first volume is something that I feel is a big mitzvah to write, and that is about my hometown, Tzitev Yam, where I was born, because I want to simply make a memorial of Tzitev Yam. Now, recently came to my attention an article that a Dr. Finkelman, who lives in Jerusalem, he works with Atid, which is one of Rabbi Braunberger's undertakings, and he wrote an article how the Haredi world tries to claims that it's a continuation of the shtetl in the old home in Europe, in Eastern Europe. Now, and he questions whether the shtetl was as beautiful and as pure and as holy as it's drawn to be. Now, when I'm going to write about Tzitev Yam, I'm also going to write the truth as Tzitev Yam was, and everyone will be able to see that it's not the ideal Torah shtetl that is portrayed in the Jewish Observer literature. I mention Jewish Observer because Dr. Finkelman writes about that. But I see no reason why our Haredi world must be a continuation of the shtetl of Eastern Europe. We have our own code, we have our own Torah code, and we should try to live up to. And if we deviate from it somehow, as Lithuanian shtetl did to a certain degree, and we're trying to go back to it and try to be improved on the Lithuanian shtetl, what's wrong with that? We should try to improve on anything that wasn't perfect in the Lithuanian shtetl. But anyway, that is my next project, Be'ezrat Hashem, to write a continuation of Making of a Gadol, but skipping over till what Tzipid Yam was like, when my father became a Shrav in 1926, and when he left it in 1937, and then if I live as long as Rav Yashiv is lived so far, he's 98 now, I'll be able to fill in the years between 1909 and 1926. I'll be able to fill in those years too and make it the second volume of the Making of a Gadol.
Thank you. That's good to hear. So it sounds to me like you're going on with Making of a Gadol after the book on your hometown. I just want to point out that Dr. Yoel Finkelman was just in Toronto for our 7th Annual Renewing Our Spirit Conference and actually stayed at my home, and is a wonderful scholar. A number of our listeners would like you to comment on possible parallels between the banning of your book and other bannings that have taken place recently in the Orthodox community, and even ostracization that took place earlier. A number of listeners want you to comment on whether there are any possible parallels between the banning of your book and the banned treatment of Rabbi Natan Slifkin, with whom I know you are familiar with that whole situation. And another listener would like to know if you feel any kinship with Rabbi Soloveitchik, not in the sense that the Rav was banned, but in the sense of a certain kind of ostracization that he received in the Haredi world. I know in his writings, Rav Shach wrote explicitly that he was very upset with certain writings of Rav Soloveitchik, etc. So if you could begin with parallels to Rabbi Slifkin and then comment on any possible parallels to Rabbi Soloveitchik.
As far as Rabbi Slifkin, I do know him, and in Anatomy of a Ban, I do mention the banning of his book. As you said, his ostracization. In the bans on my book, my name was never mentioned. Just the book was mentioned. I think it was out of respect for my father that the name Natan Kamenetsky wasn't exposed as the author of the evil Making of a Gadol. Now, insofar as the banning of Rabbi Slifkin's books, let me just say that my brother, Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky, I think he is the Gadol in America now, at first did not go along with the bans on Rabbi Slifkin. As a matter of fact, I noted that one of the first people who came out against Rabbi Slifkin, he writes that he knows to read, he reads English, and someone for whom the honor of Torah was dear approached him and said, Rabbi Slifkin's book says that the world is in existence for millions and millions of years, and the universe is billions of years, And he says, this has to be, this chas v'shalom, this has to be banned. So when he stresses that someone for whom the honor of Torah is dear, he came to tell him that, seems to imply that Rabbi Nachum Slifkin, to him the honor of Torah is not dear. But if it's the other way around, it's because the honor of Torah is dear to Rabbi Slifkin that he wrote his books to try to make the Torah consistent with science. Because the honor of Torah was dear to him is why he wrote these books. Now, I think that when Rabbi Eliashiv also joined the ban on Rabbi Slifkin, when he was told that Rabbi Slifkin's claims about the world being so many years old and the way that it does not contradict science is based on opinions of Gdolim of earlier generations who held that way. So Rabbi Eliashiv is supposed to have said that those Gdolim held that way, but since we don't agree with them now, so therefore anyone who posits their approach should be banned. All right, but in other words, he's saying that if the son of the Rambam wrote things like this, would live in nowadays, he would be banned. That's the logic behind it. Of course, it's very difficult to go along with it. And if someone doesn't go along with it, I wouldn't exactly call him an apikoros. The way his book was banned, he was also not given a chance to face his detractors. He wasn't given a chance, which I feel was wrong. It should have been discussed with him. You also mentioned, did you mention any other?
I had mentioned Rav Soloveitchik. I'm going to put that to the side just for the moment and ask you a larger question, given what you've just said about Rav Slifkin and yourself, which is a number of our listeners would like to know how you feel about basically the era of the Gedolim today versus those of your father's generation. Your father's generation, we're looking at your father, Rav Moshe, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Soloveitchik, and you seem to be narrating that there's been a change in the environment, that in the words of one of our listeners, there's an environment of banning and bullying. And they want to know if this kind of thing went on to this extent in your father's generation and those before him, and if not, why has it changed, do you think?
I think it has changed. First of all, I'd like to tell you that I write this in Making of a Gadol, that my father once remarked about a certain great posek that he shouldn't be a leader in Klal Yisrael because he didn't study under Rabbi Finkel, under the altar of Slobodka. You mentioned him earlier. The point is that in my father's time, when the Haredi world was not as insular as it is now, simply it wasn't as large, it wasn't as self-sufficient, it had to live in a world which is not Haredi. And therefore the leaders of that world had to be knowledgeable of the modern world. And the author of Slobodka taught that to his Talmidim. He taught that you have to know the Torah, in other words, halacha. You have to know and live a life of Musar, and you also have to be knowledgeable of the modern world, because the Haredi world wasn't insular; it was part of the bigger world. And when the Sabbat Yeshiva first came to a branch was opened in Israel, in the city of Hebron, which is in the news nowadays, the Sabbat Yeshiva established itself in Hebron, not in Jerusalem, where the old Yeshiv was. And in Hebron, the Sabbat Yeshiva Talmidim didn't dress all in black. as the Frum Society of Jerusalem dressed with the black hats and long pants and beards, the Sabbat Sherebach and Sheikh, and they wore light clothing and they dressed in the modern fashion. And he was a progenitor of Sabbatkin by people from the old Yishuv living in Meir Shearim. And he was approached, why don't your students dress the way we do? And his answer was, because he's combating the secular world, and he has to dress them in a way that they can compete with university students. At that time, the Frum world was part of the general world. And nowadays, unfortunately, I say, because the world, if the Haredi society, is large enough to be a world by itself, but the whole world has become a global village, has shrunk, and all societies must intermingle. And therefore, being less insular, if time will make it, the Gdolim of today who are able to live in the world and therefore ban books such as mine or as Rabbi Slifkin's, because they can say our society, the Orthodox, the Haredi society has certain different codes and different books and different outlooks. We live by ourselves, but it won't last forever. It won't last for long, as a matter of fact. In fact, the problems now with the global problems with the economy is also going to affect the Haredi world. That there'll be less people learning. It'll affect changes in the Haredi world too. And it'll go back to what it was in my father's days, when the Haredi world was part of a general world, and the Gdolim had to react to the society in general, and they couldn't just separate from it and say, we have our own way of doing things.
And do you see that as a positive development? In other words, if your thesis that has been expressed by many, that the worldwide financial economic crisis is going to impact on Haredi society in terms of the number of people who are able to learn full-time, in terms of the number of people who will be forced to seek work. If that thesis is correct, and there will be a change within Haredi society, a change that has been occurring for the last number of years, even though it may not be talked about a lot, do you see the further permeation of the outside world into Haredi society, and the fact that Haredi society may have to integrate more with the outside world, do you see that as a positive or as a negative?
The fact that the secular... Well, I can't say it's a positive or a negative. I can just say that this is what I foresee happening. Now, when the Haredi world was able to be more insular, it could be it promoted more Torah study. There's so many more people learning now and writing books and things like that. Writing Torah books, I'm speaking about. In all branches, even not only in things that concern us now, people are writing now about parts of Torah which were neglected. And there weren't people studying, let's say, Zroim or Kachim or Talosh, which was part of the Tayag mitzvahs, which weren't studied, and people were studying them because the society lived by itself. Naturally, if we're going to have more of the outside world, as you said, permeating into the Torah world, the Torah study will suffer from it. There'll be less Torah study. I can't say that will be beneficial. On the contrary, it will be detrimental. But this is what society will look like. And until Mashiach comes, and the perfect society and the utopia will come to be, they will have to live with all kinds of societies and all kinds of situations. and I see the situation changing, and the Gdolim who are Gdolim today will not be able to be the Gdolim of what I see is forthcoming. I'll tell you, the Shroom world does not appreciate what the Bali Tshuva have contributed to the Shroom world now. But let's say now we have Shroom doctors here in Israel. Many of them didn't have a Shroom education altogether. This was before Einstein Medical School was open. And there are many fields where the Bali Tshuva who are educated in another aspect of civilization have benefited the Haredi world and the Rinnet. And I don't think it's been acknowledged as much as it should be. But the Haredi world has taken advantage of the outside world by swallowing in these Bali Tshuva and making the Bali Tshuva part of the Haredi world. But eventually, when the Haredi world will not be able to be a Zin Shiver as it is now, the Gdolim will also not be able to be a Zin Shiver, and the books such as mine, our Rabbi Slifkin's, will no longer be able to be banned. Now, when I mention the
You're not transmitting. Are you? Did you lock down the button? Now you are.
And the Rav Shlitzk was a big Talmid Chacham, a gigantic stature. So they try to play down because he has secular studies with him too. So I think it's part of that problem with the post-Slabodka world, which did not require of his own to be knowledgeable of modern society, that Rav Soloveitchik also, his stature was demoted, and he wasn't accepted in the Haredi world as a positive figure.
I just want to conclude by asking you a last question about yourself. I'm wondering what the effect of all of this controversy has had on you personally, whether it's been very difficult for you or whether you've been able to carry on properly, and also about the private manuscript of Anatomy of a Ban, why you've decided not to publish it or make the manuscript available, but rather keep it in perpetuity. I'm not sure. You seem to suggest it won't be published unless it's posthumously.
I have a difference of opinion here. I have a difference of opinion here with my members of my family. My family does not want to ever publish the other parts of the Anatomy of a Ban, but I do want to publish it, even though I do not intend to publish it in the near future, as long as some of the figures I write about are still alive. But perhaps the other parts of the Anatomy of Ben will be published after I'm gone already. But I think they're worthy of perpetuation in the at least in the academic world. To know what happened, and to be able to evaluate our present Haredi society from the point of view of the bands and how they were made. I think eventually, maybe not in my time, but in your time, Dr. Malamet, you'll be able to read all three parts of the whole trilogy, the whole Anatomy of the Band.
Sounds good to me. Rav Kamenetsky, we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning, and I personally want to wish you good health, long life, and continued success, both with your family and also in your writing. And we hope to see you again.
Thank you.
I want to thank Elliot, if I may, for his insightful and insightful questions, his sharp commentary, and it's really always a pleasure having him leading our panels for those who are outside of the Toronto area, who are meeting him for the first time. And I want to thank everybody for being on board on behalf of Toromotion. And we want to thank our technical team, and we look forward to seeing you again online. We have many, many classes all the time, and both in Toronto live and online, and it's really been a pleasure. And I want to wish everybody a Shavua Tov, and to thank our guest speaker, Rav Kamenetsky. It's really been a pleasure listening to you and hearing, and especially with the Toronto connection, adding a little extra. But it's really a pleasure to have you, and we wish you, as Elliot said, much hatzlacha and to write for many, many years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.